For the last 18 months, Syria has been fighting an insurgency that has been interpreted differently by different people with strong interest in its outcome. One interpretation explains the Syrian insurgency as a struggle for democracy, human rights, and freedom of thought and expression, long suppressed by an oppressive, intolerant, and brutal regime. This is the interpretation propagated in the West by voices of the Syrian opposition in exile and has been accepted without exception by Western countries, including the United States. Another interpretation recognizes the domestic roots of the Syrian insurgency, but rejects any foreign intervention in Syria and calls for an internal dialogue between the government and its opposition to agree on a set of reforms to liberalize the Syrian regime and end the conflict. The call for dialogue was received positively by some opposition groups, but was rejected firmly by the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the standard bearer of the opposition and the leader of the insurgency. The Muslim Brotherhood settles for nothing short of the fall of the Assad regime. Regarding this increasingly bloody conflict, which threatens to overflow Syria's borders, I would like to make the following comments. First, the conflict in Syria is not one for democracy, human rights, and freedom of thought and expression. Far from it. If it were, you wouldn't see states like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Oman backing the Syrian rebels. Collectively, these states are known as the Gulf Cooperation Council, or the GCC, which was formed in 1981 as a response to the Iran-Iraq war at that time. None of the above states has a constitution. I repeat, none of the above state has a constitution. None believes in democracy, human rights, and the freedom of thought and expression. Rulers, whether sheikhs or sheikhs, emirs or kings, are absolutists. When some Syrian expatriates demonstrated in support of the Syrian rebels in the UAE, United Arab Emirates, they were expelled. Saudi Arabia today leads the world in capital punishment, whether you know it or not. This is true. There are approximately 23,000 detainees in Saudi prisons, the majority of whom are college graduates, which means they are political prisoners in Saudi prisons, the majority. Is it likely that these states back the Syrian opposition and finance the rebellion in order to establish democracy in Syria? If so, why don't they establish democracy in their own states first? Last March, GCC troops, the bulk of which came from Saudi Arabia, extinguished a nascent democratic movement in Bahrain for wider parliamentary representation, and the United States kept mum about it. Shortly after that, the United States approved of consignments of arms to Bahrain. Furthermore, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is backed, financed, and armed by the GCC states, at least in part, has had a violent history and is far away from being democratic. The second point I want to make here regarding the nature of the conflict in Syria. The conflict in Syria is essentially a sectarian conflict, Sunnis versus Shias. These are the two largest sects in Islam. In the Arab world, Sunnis dominate Shias in the Arabian Peninsula, the Gulf states, and elsewhere. Sunni extremists like Wahhabis and Salafis, who dominate in Saudi Arabia, consider Shiism a heresy. Wahhabis and Salafis are fundamentalist movements in Islam, which go back in history to the days of Prophet Muhammad and his early successors, and they want to restore what they call the pure Islam, which existed at that time. They want to restore the way of life of that time. They also want to restore the caliphate, succession, in other words, which Mustafa Kemal Ataturk abolished in 1924. Now, Syria is about 70% Sunni, but headed by an Alawite president in alliance with non-Arab Shiite Iran. Iraq, on the other hand, has a Shi'i majority, but Sunnis always held power in Iraq from 1921 to 2003. With the American invasion and the overthrow of President Saddam Hussein, political power in Iraq shifted to the Shiites, which was resented strongly, especially by fundamentalist Saudi Arabia. With the balance of power apparently shifting away from Sunnism in favor of Shiism and Iran, Saudi Arabia felt insecure and suddenly in face-to-face confrontation with Shia Iran over the domination of the Gulf politically, economically, and religiously. I should point out here that until 2003 and the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, Iraq was the balancer of Iran in the Gulf. Iraq always stood against Iran in the area. With the destruction of Iraq at the hands of the Americans, suddenly Saudi Arabia faced Iran face to face. And of course, Saudi Arabia cannot face Iran because its population is limited. Iran is a country of about 85 million people, and they are far more advanced socially and politically than the Saudis. So Saudi Arabia felt threatened. With the outbreak of Syria's insurgency against the so-called Alawite Assad regime, Saudi Arabia, heading the GCC states, backed the insurgency. The GCC states hope to topple President Assad, restore Syria's presidency to the Sunnites, and end the Syria-Iran alliance to weaken both Iran and Syria. Now, the longer the Syrian insurgency lasts, the more it becomes radicalized, and the more it assumes the aura of a religious conflict, attracting Sunni Muslim extremists from all over, such as Wahhabis, Salafis, and elements of Al-Qaeda. This is in addition again to the Muslim Brotherhood, which leads the fight in Syria against the regime. So these extremist elements are being invited into Syria to join the jihad, or holy war, against the Alawite regime, the so-called Alawite regime. Now, a well-informed Western diplomat was quoted yesterday in the press saying that Syria is becoming like a magnet for jihadists from Chechnya, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and Libya. If so, Syria is becoming like the Afghanistan of the 1980s, when we encouraged jihadis to go to Afghanistan, we trained them, we armed them in order to fight the Soviet Union. And we produced somebody known as Osama bin Laden. It is well known, if you read the papers of the past few days, sometimes truths come in the American papers. Sometimes. I haven't experienced an unprofessional press such as the American press in covering the Syria conflict. But still, sometimes, some truths come out. The press in the past few days talked about jihadis or jihadists infiltrating the Free Syria Army. This is supposedly composed of defectors from the Syrian army, but it has become also a magnet for many people to come and join. Everybody is welcome. The commander of an FSA, Free Syria Army, recently addressed his followers outside Aleppo saying, "Those of you whose intentions are not for God, they had better stay home. Whereas, if your intention is to fight for God, then you can go for jihad and you gain an afterlife in heaven. If you die, you go to heaven." This reminds me of the indulgences of the Middle Ages, when the Pope told crusaders going to Palestine, "If you fight for Christ and you die, you go to heaven. You don't stay in the purgatory. If you live, you have the good life in the Near East." And of course, the Near East at that time was far richer than Europe was. Okay, so this is how this commander addressed his followers outside the gates of Aleppo. Now, battalions in the Free Syria Army are given names with strongly religious connotations, such as the Sahaba Battalion. Who are the Sahaba? Who were the Sahaba? The companions of Prophet Muhammad. Other battalions were known as the Tawheed Battalion. What is Tawheed? The recognition of the oneness of Allah. Now, these terms are far from being secular terms. They are religious terms. And other battalions of the Free Syria Army are named after the early caliphs in Islam. Abu Bakr, Umar ibn al-Khattab, Uthman, and Ali ibn Abi Talib. Now, These battalions fight under the black flag of Prophet Muhammad. Is this a secular uprising for democracy and human rights? You think about it. The transformation of the Syrian insurgency to a holy war augurs very badly for religious minorities in the Middle East and beyond, because Muslim extremists such as Salafis and Wahhabis consider the whole world as Dar al-Islam, or the abode of Islam. Recent accounts, past week or so, highlighted the precariousness of the Christian presence in Syria. Some churches and some monasteries in Syria have been hit. I can't confirm whether they were hit deliberately or by accident, but we know they were hit. Some priests were killed. The third point, foreign intervention has aggravated and prolonged the Syrian conflict. From the inception of the conflict, the U.S., leading the Western powers, took a very hostile stand against the Syrian regime. Robert Ford, as has already been advanced, Robert Ford, our former ambassador to Damascus, visited the city of Hama, a center of the opposition, and reportedly urged the rebels to carry on. Now, there is an international law that states shall not interfere in the domestic affairs of other states. I wonder whatever happened to that law. Okay? When President Assad, early in the rebellion, issued an amnesty and told the rebels to lay down their arms and walk free, Victoria Nuland of the State Department told them not to do so. Not to do so. Our Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, went to the Middle East this week to reassure the enemies of Syria that Assad would fall. Yesterday, the Obama administration authorized U.S. agencies to finance the FSA. This was yesterday in the news. Spokesmen of the White House and the State Department frequently opined that Assad's days were numbered. This is from the beginning of the conflict. One of them referred to Assad as a dead man walking. A dead man walking. Well, this dead man has walked a long distance and is still walking despite economic sanctions, travel bans, and undiplomatic name calling. What the Western press doesn't tell us is the fact that the presumed dead man enjoys the support of more than 50% of his people and the bulk of his army. There were studies about this, but they never made the Western press. They never made the Western press. Why would the U.S. assume such open hostility toward Syria? Here there are several factors to consider, true or not. To begin with, the U.S. blames Syria for the lack of Palestinian-Israeli peace and for granting shelter to Palestinian resistance leaders. Additionally, the U.S. backs the GCC states in their position vis-à-vis Syria for economic, military, and political reasons. Economically, the GCC states are very rich in oil and natural gas, which the West needs. Militarily, Bahrain is the home of America's 5th fleet in the Persian Gulf. And Qatar is home for America's largest military base in the Gulf area. Then we have the Israeli factor and the susceptibility of the United States to Israeli pressure. Romney just went to Israel, as well as other countries. What did he go to Israel for? To beg for votes and to ask for money for the campaign. And he's not alone. Obama visited Israel before his first election. And this has become standard on the part of American candidates for office, whether in Congress or in the presidency. Last but not least, the U.S. stands to reap political benefits should Assad fall. If Assad falls and a pro-Western regime is installed in Syria, it would mean the end of the Iran-Syria alliance and the termination of the Russian naval base on the Syrian coast. Russia has a naval base to which Russian ships come to be repaired or to get supplies, etc. Not only Iran would be weakened, but also her military relations with Syria and Hezbollah would come to an end. Hezbollah would lose its Syrian link with Iran. This as much was promised by Burhan Ghalioun, the former head of the SNC, the Syrian National Council, should the Syrian opposition come to power. Haytham al-Maleh and Burhan Ghalioun were the strongest advocates in the West calling for Western intervention in Syria. They remind me of Ahmad Shalabi, the exile from Iraq, who spent his time in Washington, D.C., financed by the State Department, to drum up support for intervention in Iraq. He finally told the Americans, if you intervene in Iraq, the Iraqis will meet you with roses. With roses. Ahmad Shalabi today is a member of the Iraqi parliament, and he's living on his millions, if not billions, that he made before. He was a rotten banker, by the way. And he was wanted in Jordan for embezzlement. Now, all this, which I have mentioned, the end of the Syria-Iran alliance and the termination of the Russian base along the coast and other things, this may set the stage for an attack on Iran as the last thing. Because the United States is afraid today, if we attack Iran, or if Israel attack Iran, the whole Middle East will burn up. If we separate Syria from Iran, if we decapitate Hezbollah in Lebanon, then Israel would be safe in the north vis-a-vis Syria and vis-a-vis Lebanon. So I would say that should this happen, Assad falls and a pro-Western regime comes to Syria, very likely Iran will be the last to be attacked. The fourth point I want to make here pertains to Lebanon. I spent over a month in Lebanon from June 15 to July 18. And I observed the Syrian conflict from a close distance. And Lebanon still has freedom of the press. And the press in Lebanon publishes everything, pro and anti. This is good about Lebanon. This is the only, well, one of the few good aspects about Lebanon. Freedom of the press. So the fourth and last point I want to make pertains to Lebanon. This is the country that stands to be impacted the most by developments in Syria. Whatever happens in Syria reverberates in Lebanon. The Lebanese people are sharply divided internally, right in the middle, between pro and anti-Syria. Sunnis in general and right-wing Christian parties like the Falange and the Lebanese forces are strongly pro-West and anti-Syria. They are led by the Saad Hariri coalition. Saad Hariri was the son of the former Hariri who was assassinated in Lebanon in 2005. And to the present time, we don't know who assassinated him. Four Lebanese generals, they remained in jail for 4 years on the basis that they were involved in his assassination. And finally, they were let out because there was no evidence about them being involved in the assassination of Hariri. His name was Rafiq Hariri. His son is Saad Hariri. He leads the pro-Western, anti-Syrian coalition in Lebanon. Now, Shiites, on the other hand, led by Hezbollah and Amal, along with Christian followers of General Michel Aoun, are pro-Syria. Tension in the country is high. Already, clashes have broken out in the northern city of Tripoli and elsewhere, and casualties have fallen between dead and wounded. Arms smuggling through Lebanon to Syria leads to clashes. The Lebanese army tries to maintain a tenuous peace by separating the combatants. But if fighting breaks out on a large scale and in many places, the army may not be able to contain the fight. The government, which is backed by the pro-Syria coalition, is weak and not known for decisive action. It operates on the basis of consensus, and consensus is sometimes difficult to achieve. It allows Syrian refugees to enter Lebanon, but doesn't provide for them and bars the establishment of refugee camps. Lebanon seems not to be willing to repeat the experience of the Palestinians in Lebanon. Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon have been there since 1948. Now, since the government does not allow the establishment of refugee camps and does not provide for the refugees, this means only wealthy Syrians are welcome. To date, over 30,000 Syrians have taken refuge in Lebanon, mainly Christians. And in the past 2 weeks or so, when fighting broke out in Damascus and is still taking place in Aleppo, many Syrian Christians came to Lebanon for refuge. The Lebanese cabinet seems paralyzed even in dealing with vital domestic issues. A Salafi Muslim cleric with little following, known as Sheikh Ahmad Al-Asir, has blocked a vital economic artery leading to the city of Sidon, South Lebanon. He states that he wouldn't lift the blockade of this road until Hezbollah gives up his stockpiles of arms. He wants Hezbollah to surrender its weapons. Every Lebanese individual knows, whether pro-Hezbollah or not, that Hezbollah is not going to give its weapons up. This is a given in Lebanon. So he will continue the siege until Hezbollah gives up its stockpiles of arms. Now, since the government did not take forceful action to open the road to Sidon, and it's well known that the people of Sidon are Sunni Muslims by and large, and all of them were hurt by the blocking of this road, and they demonstrated for opening the road, yet the government didn't take any action to open the road. The inaction of the government encouraged other disgruntled groups in Lebanon to block other roads until the government addressed their demands. And this happened. Sometimes they agreed to lift the blockade, sometimes they didn't. Including the only road leading to the Lebanese International Airport was blocked a couple of times. Now, there is a feeling in Lebanon on the part of many Lebanese that nobody is in charge of the country and anyone can get away with anything. This feeling has encouraged lawlessness. Lebanon certainly doesn't have the government to maintain law and order, let alone handle issues of war and peace, should the Syrian chaos reach Lebanon. Thank you very much.